Okay, Proverbs 25. And we finished last week with verse number 5. And as I was studying for this week, I noticed that all of the verses kind of have a similar theme of humility and self-control. So anyway, let's go ahead and we'll go to the Lord in prayer, and then we will we'll go ahead and look at these. Dear Lord, we come to you today. Thank you for your blessings, and we thank you so much for all that you do for us. Thank you for being so good to us, Lord. We thank you for the time that we have to come out to church, Lord. And Lord, we thank you for your word that we can study and we can learn from, that we can grow from, Lord. And I just pray, ask you that you would just please be with our church, that we would see it grow, see it have an impact in the community. We'd like to see people coming out on Wednesday nights again. And Lord, I just pray that you would just be with all our church folks, the things they've got going on. I pray be with the ones that are traveling, the ones that are sick, Lord. I ask you to be with Matthew and his family, Lord, and in their time of loss, Lord. And I just ask you, Lord, just to help me tonight as I teach, be with each person here, that they would gain exactly what they need from the service, Lord. And all these things I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, verse number 6 and 7, where we'll start. And so verse 6 says, put not forth thyself in the presence of the king, and stand not in the place of great men. For better it is to be said unto thee, come up hither, than that thou shouldest be put lower in the presence of the prince whom thine eyes have seen. So these verses are warning against self-promotion. And this is something that is very much needed in the days of TikTok and Instagram, where everybody's trying to promote themselves. Yeah. And everyone wants to be an influencer, even though they haven't reached a place of influence, right? And so anyway, youthful pride demands a place at the table. They want to be seen and they want to be heard. They think they deserve attention and respect, but that's not how it works. Here Solomon specifically refers to kings and great men, and places in those circles must be earned, right? And so for you to think that you are so important that you can just thrust yourself in the middle of something, or that people have to listen to you just on the basis of who you are, is not really the way it works. Regardless of what circle we're dealing with, it's better to be invited or welcomed in than to force your way into it. So, for instance, if you're hearing a conversation among a group that you're not a part of, it's better to be asked to contribute than to butt in and be rejected.
Yeah.
If people talking about something and you try to push your way into the conversation, they say, excuse me, I wasn't talking to you. Though this is an A-B conversation, see your way out of it.
Yeah, the whole thing
just dies.
Do what?
Or the conversation just dies. Or if a person goes to a job and expects for them to be promoted just because of whatever, because they haven't earned it or anything, but instead be working diligently, be working and doing your very best at it, and allow your character and your actions to speak for you, and that to be the basis on which you're promoted, rather than just expecting for it to happen or trying to manipulate and make it happen. And so how is it that you'll be asked? Whenever your work and your behavior tells them that you have something of value to contribute. We go back to Proverbs chapter 18 and verse 16. It says, a man's gift maketh room for him and bringeth him before great men. And, of course, we've already looked at that verse, but whenever a person has something to offer, then it makes place for them if they are able to contribute. So you make a name for yourself and you'll be sought for, rather than making a fool of yourself trying to be something that you aren't. And we see something similar being told by Jesus in Luke chapter 14. Verses 7 through 10, it says, and he put forth a parable to those who were bidden, when he marked how they chose out the chief rooms, saying unto them, when thou art bidden of any man to a wedding, sit not down in the highest room, lest a more honorable man than thou be bidden of him. And he that bade him, bade thee and him come and say to thee, give this man place, and thou begin with shame to take the lowest room. But when thou art bidden, go and sit in the lowest room, that when he that bade thee cometh, he may say unto thee, friend, go up higher. Then shalt thou have worship in the presence of them that sat at meat with thee. And so the picture is of a banquet hall of a feast or something, and one person trying to make themselves be seen as important, making themselves the center of attention, going and trying to set as if they are the most important person there. Imagine a wedding and someone coming, inviting themselves to sit at the bride and groom's table. And they're like, excuse me, that was reserved for our family. That was reserved for our friends. That was reserved for people that we like. Why don't you go sit somewhere else? That'd be embarrassing, right? But for you to come in and sit down in a lower seat and for them to say, hey, wait, what are you doing over there? You're special. You're important. You come over here and you be with us. And then, so you've got one that you're trying to promote self, and you go away in shame, or you've got the one that you're being promoted by others and you're being called up in honor. And so there's a difference there. So that's the danger of self-promotion, that you end up making a fool of yourself and trying to be in somewhere that you have not earned the right to, right? Okay, any questions or comments on that one? Okay, then verse number 8. It says, go not forth hastily to strive, lest thou know not what to do in the end thereof, when thy neighbor hath put thee to shame. So this verse is telling us that we need to choose our fights wisely, right? Whenever it says there in verse 8, go not forth hastily to strive, rushing into a fight, rushing into a battle. You ever see someone's mouth outrun their brain and get themselves into trouble? Happens frequently, right? So this is kind of the idea. So someone, there was a video that was going around there a while back about a dog that was just like a little tiny dog, and he started yapping at a big dog through a gate. As soon as they opened up the gate, he retreated with his tail between his legs. So kind of a similar idea to that. But anyway, think before you act or before you speak. Some will fight or argue at the drop of a hat. And unfortunately, they're not going to take time to consider if they can win the fight or even if it's worth winning. And I think that's one of the keys here, is that a lot of fights aren't worth winning. And so we'll put a lot of emotional and relational energy into something that doesn't actually benefit anybody. And that's something that we need to stay away from. And so you may win a fight and end up losing your testimony or losing relationships or losing influence, or you may not be able to win the fight and you have to retreat. So to be all bold and brash and rush into something and only to be defeated. And of course, we're thinking about this in fights, physical fights, right? But we're more likely to be in emotional or intellectual battles, right? Trying to win arguments. And we need to have our facts straight before we enter into an argument, right? It's like the joke, I see you, or I would challenge you to a battle of wits, but I see you're unarmed. But anyway, there are several examples of this very thing in Kings and Chronicles of men who, or kings, who wanted to engage in a fight that challenged other rulers and then ended up not being able to back it up. Can you think of any of them? Examples in Kings and Chronicles of kings who picked a fight that they couldn't win. Didn't think before they acted. Everybody's drawing a blank. There was the one king of Judah that went up against the king of Israel, and he put forth the king of Israel put forth the story, I forget, the allegory, if you will, about the bramble challenging the cedar of Lebanon to a fight.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that one? And basically he said, I have no quarrel with you, go home before you get beat. And he came at him anyway, and he got beat, just like he was promised. That was one good example there. I guess in a way, the Syrians came up, and whenever the the prophet blinded them and led them to the middle of Samaria. They weren't anticipating that battle, right? Or just a simple one, David and Goliath. I guess that would have been in Samuel. But Goliath came out and he was making all of his challenges and running his mouth, and then he ended up being quieted eternally. Okay, so whenever facing a fight, and as I said, this isn't going to be always physical. It might be emotional or intellectual battle. But whenever you're facing a fight, a few things that I think would be helpful to ask. First of all, and I guess these may not be in order of importance, but I think it's important to ask, am I equipped to engage in this battle? Do I have what it takes? You know, count the cost before you start out, but that might kind of get into one of our next ones. Anyway, so am I equipped to engage? Do I have my facts straight? Do I know what I'm talking about? Am I able to... I'm trying to be careful with my wording. I don't want to say, am I able to take this person on? But it is a battle, right? And so, am I equipped? Do I have what it takes before I rush into this? So that's going to take a little bit of evaluation of who you're coming up against in the topic or the situation that's at hand. Another one is it necessary? And I think that's a big one, is it necessary? And some people think every battle is necessary. Every hill is one to die on.
I think the discernment with that one comes with maturity.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think some of it comes with experience, which is a lot with maturity. But you fight some unnecessary battles, and it makes you less willing to take on future unnecessary ones. Mm-hmm. Or the other way around, if you see a few battles that are actually necessary, ones that are important enough to fight, it makes all the other ones not of your concern anymore. It helps prioritize a little bit. And so some of the things that I believe makes a battle, a fight, an argument, if you will, necessary is if you're doing it to protect someone, right? And so if someone is going to be hurt, something at a loss, then by all means, stand up, protect them, do something about it, right? Even if you might lose, you still need to stand up and protect. For correction, if someone is going in error, then that's a time to confront them. That's a time to interject yourself there. That's a time to go into battle. And then also to defend. And there's a difference between protect and defend, right? But anyway, to defend. And thinking about this from an intellectual point of view, defending the faith, defending your actions, defending your beliefs. Defending your God, right?
Yeah.
Defending your family. Sometimes you have to speak up against things that are not true, not right.
Yeah.
I do think that whenever it comes to self, we need to be careful about running to our own defense.
Mm-hmm.
Because oftentimes that's pride. It gets ourselves in trouble. Okay? And so we have to be careful with the idea of defending. So we said, am I equipped? Is it necessary? Is the potential cost worth it? Because anytime that you engage in a battle, there's going to be a cost associated. We think about all this that's going on in Ukraine or this that's going on in Iran. That is a literal battle, right? And if a country doesn't have what it takes to finance their militaries and do all the things that keeps that going and to defend themselves, then they probably don't want to jump into a battle. They need to go and seek for conditions of peace, right? But for us, whenever we have a fight with a friend, with a neighbor, with a coworker, or with a spouse or whatever, whenever you have a fight with one of these people, you have to decide, is the cost of fighting this out worth it? Or am I better off to drop my weapons and seek for peace and not have to come to a decisive win or loss,
yes.
Right? And so the potential cost, I might lose friends over this. I might lose relationships over this. I may lose peace over this, right? And so is it worth it to fight this battle? And then the last one that I've written down here is, can I engage in this battle in a Christ-like way? Can I do this without losing my testimony? And so if we think about this in a way of how most people bicker and fight and things like that, all the stuff online, people engaging in their own little battles online, which is really a waste of time. But I was talking with Brother Thompson the other day about this, about even pastors engaging in arguments online.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for one, it's not worth it,
right?
It's not necessary. It's not for any reason but to protect your own self usually. But it's impossible to do those things usually in a Christ-like way. Okay? And so, am I equipped? Is it necessary? Is it worth it? And can I do it in a Christ-like way? And so there's a lot of unnecessary strife that we involve ourselves in. And it's usually out of pride. It's the idea, I have to be right. I have to have the last word. I can't let them make me look bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so we bristle ourselves a little bit. We jump in the ring and we start trying to slug it out with the other person.
Yeah.
And we all look like fools in the end. And so what it says there in verse number 8. Go not forth hastily to strive. It doesn't say not to strive. It doesn't say never fight. It doesn't say to be a pacifist and just roll over and let people walk over you. But go not hastily to strive. Because if you go hastily, if you don't think it out, if you don't go with a plan, if you don't approach it the right way, it says, lest thou know not what to do in the end thereof. Don't know what you're doing when thy neighbor hath put thee to shame. When you lose, right? Okay, so any questions or comments on that? Okay, verses 9 and 10. Okay, verses 9 and 10. It says, debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another, lest he that heareth it put thee to shame, and thine infamy turn not away. So it's telling us here, it works best to work out private disputes privately.
Yes.
The idea behind this, debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself, and discover not a secret to another. Don't air your dirty laundry. In Matthew chapter 18, Jesus tells his disciples that whenever a brother offends you, go to him alone and work it out in private, right? Then if he won't hear you, then you involve select people, certain people, right? Take one or two with you. It's saying don't broadcast it. Don't broadcast your drama. And so it gives you the best chance of resolution whenever you go to that person in private. Because think about it, if someone publicly brings their beef against you, then that escalates things, doesn't it? It involves your flesh in the matter. It causes you to be on the defense, right? And if someone comes to you privately and says, hey, I've got a concern, I've got a question, I've got something I want to talk to you about, let's work this out. A lot better chance of working that out than, hey, guess what so-and-so did to me? Guess what so-and-so said? Oh, I've been mistreated. Passive-aggressive posts online. Okay, so if you air your dirty laundry publicly, both parties are going to go on the defense instead of trying to work things out. Additionally, you bring in everybody else's opinions, and you make the problem a lot bigger than it has to be. And as you get other people involved, a lot of times you are looking for other people just to validate the way that you feel. That's usually what ends up happening. You go and tell friends about it. You post about it online just to get people to come in and affirm your feelings, affirm your biases and whatnot. And then that causes you to dig your heels in and be that much more rooted in your position and that much less likely to bend or to compromise or to admit any wrongdoing. And so you make the problem bigger, you make it a lot less likely to be able to work through it. Plenty of times people have made private matters public thinking that it would make the other person look bad or pressure the other person to yield, only to end up making themselves look bad instead. And we've all seen that, people making a big stink out of something online or in public some way, spreading rumors and whatnot, and it made the person who was trying to slander the other one look worse than the person they were trying to slander. Kind of just shows everybody what kind of person they are. It's like, stay away from them. Look at the mess they're stirring up. In the end, it comes down to whether you want to put things right with others or you want to make yourself feel better. Mm-hmm. That's the question. Because in this, it says, debate thy cause with thy neighbor himself. So you've got a cause, you've got a problem. Do I want to fix this or do I want to make myself feel better? Do I want to get things right with them or do I want to be right? Mm-hmm. And so just know that selfish motives usually backfire. The majority of time, selfish motives are going to backfire. Okay, any questions or comments on that? Okay, verses 11 through 13. It says, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. As an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so is a wise reprover upon an obedient ear. As the coat of snow in the time of harvest, so is a faithful messenger to him that sent him, for he refresheth the soul of his masters. So we've got a couple as statements here. So it's drawing comparison, right? These verses build one on the other, telling us the value and importance of the right words and the right time. Some people are always speaking. Some always have to have the last word. And some just want to be heard. And it's a caution against all those. Generally speaking, the ones who have the most to say don't say the most. Right? The world often misses the wisdom of the wise because fools are too loud and too unceasing. And if you just kind of stand around and observe groups of people, it's interesting of who's speaking and who's listening. And it's usually imbalanced, right? Verse 11, a word fitly spoken is pleasant and appreciated. Whenever it says it's as apples of gold and pictures of silver, we can't really appreciate that because, you know, it's apples of gold, pictures of what's it talking about? But we can understand that it's something that is meant to be beautiful, something that's meant to be pleasant, something that artistic, if you will. Right. And so a word fitly spoken is pleasant. It's appreciated. It's like a work of art rather than just being white noise. Right. Something that's valuable rather than just a bunch of noise. In verse 12, we have a reproving word. And we usually don't like reproof, right? We don't like to be corrected. We don't like to be told we're wrong. But having someone reprove us actually makes us better. And as I've used the illustration many times, it does us no good if we are continuing to go in a wrong direction. We're not going to get where we need to be. One of the best things someone can do is turn us back the right way. So if you're trying to get to Dublin and you're going towards Sligo, and someone says, hey, you're in the wrong direction, you don't get mad and say, who are you to tell me what to do? I want to go whichever way I want. I know what I'm doing. Well, you may know what you're doing, but you're going to end up in Sligo, not Dublin. Mm-hmm. Right? Or you're going to go a really long way around to it. And so anyway, whenever someone reproves us, it makes us better. It enhances us and it enhances our lives. And so a friend that won't correct you isn't really a friend at all. Yes. And so if you only have people around you telling you exactly what you want to hear, then you got the wrong people around you. And then in verse number 13, it says, as the coat of snow in the time of harvest, so is a faithful messenger to them that send him, for he refresheth the soul of his masters. That verse has always kind of troubled me a little bit. Just because of being from a different culture and from a different climate, okay? Because if I was trying to bring in the harvest, if I was trying to get the stuff out of the garden, and it started snowing, that doesn't seem like a positive thing to me.
No.
However, if you get into the arid climates of the Middle East, then you're going to see that they had a different perspective on these things. They had a different way of looking at it. But anyway, whenever they were gathering in their harvest, it was time for the next season. They were not gathering it up as early as what we do. They don't have the means of preservation, all the different things. And so they're wanting the next season to come right behind the one that they're in. Not only that, but coming out of the really hot and dry climates, having the cool and the snow coming along behind that would be refreshing to them, right? And so with Solomon, I'm sure he came across plenty who would tell him exactly what they thought he wanted to hear. But someone who speaks truth is refreshing, and someone who can be trusted to carry forth your message, as he's saying here, a messenger, right? If you're telling someone something and you can trust them to relay that message just the way you intended it to be, that's a good thing, isn't it? But we think about the opposite. What we normally run into is people that we can't trust what they're telling us, and we can't trust them to relay a message for us either. We've all played the game telephone.
Yeah.
Pass it on. And people are not reliable. But someone who can be trusted is refreshing. Okay, verse number 14. Whoso boasteth himself of a false gift is like clouds and wind without rain. So we're still talking about weather, right? Actually, we're not talking about weather, but we're using it as an illustration. To boast of a false gift is to make claims that you can't back up. Anyone ever tell you they could do something that they couldn't actually do? Oh, I'm an excellent singer. I'm a gifted singer. Gifted in the sense of. Right? Anyway. Had to act that one out so it's not recorded. Most of a false gift would be promises that you can't keep. Think of politicians that campaign on all the things that they're going to do that they're never even going to attempt to do once they actually get elected. Plenty of those. How do people respond to them?
They elect them again.
Unfortunately, sometimes.
Yeah.
But people complain and they say, we had high hopes and then he has disappointed us. So they respond with disappointment. And so the illustration that is given here in verse 14 says it's like clouds and wind without rain. So imagine that dry, arid desert weather, and the crops are wilting and the wells are drying up and they're having trouble getting enough water for their animals and all those things. And then the breeze starts blowing through and then a cloud appears and they get excited. They're like, finally, the drought's going to be over. We're going to have plenty of water for our crops, for our animals. Our stuff's going to green back up. And then it just blows right on past and it never happens. And everybody's disappointed, right? I want to do all these things. I want to help you. I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to do that for you. And then they never do. And then you're disappointed. You can imagine all the people who came through claiming that they were prophets or apostles and then weren't actually able to do anything. We still got people today who come in and say they're going to pray over you or they're going to whack you in the forehead or whatever and bring healing. And then don't ever happen. Or they're going to prophesy and tell you what your future is going to be, health, wealth, and prosperity, as long as you give them your money.
Yeah.
They're boasting of a false gift. And it's not going to actually happen. And honestly, a lot of people do that, and it gives people a bad opinion of God, a bad taste for religion, because people make a lot of promises and have nothing to back it. People claim to have callings that they don't actually have, gifts that they don't actually possess, and it leaves a lot of people disappointed in their wake. A lot of people are just bragging about things they can do that they really can't. And this comes back to self-promotion that we talked about in verses 6 and 7. Rather than a cost to self, however, we see that this is a cost to others. So in verses 6 and 7, whenever we're talking about self-promotion, about putting yourself up in the best place, trying to get in the in other crowds and whatnot, and then you being disappointed, this one, it's you're going to disappoint other people, right? Trying to make yourself out to be something that you're not, and then other people are going to see that you're a fraud.
That's maybe moving the energy you watched a couple weeks ago about a girl trying to get a job, and absolutely everything on her resume was a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And it did take a little bit to find it out, but after that, there was quite a few people disappointed with her that they didn't keep her on the job.
Well, that's a fairly
so movie too, so.
Yeah, that's a fairly common thing with people lying about their skills on their CV trying to get the job.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot.
Might get you the job, but it might not keep it. You'll disappoint a lot of people. They're like,
the thing she was lying about though was she could speak French fluently and she could do all kinds of stock market stuff and, you know, high up stuff for this high end job, and she was just basic, never even went to college.
Mm.
So
in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 5, it says that it's better to never vow a vow than to vow a vow and not keep it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that kind of comes along the same lines of this. Don't tell someone that you can do something or that you're going to do something unless you're actually able to do that and follow through with it.
Yeah.
And this would have been an important lesson for a new king to know there are limits and not to overpromise.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, verse 15. By long forbearance is a prince persuaded, and a soft tongue breaketh the bone. Solomon's giving two pieces of advice for winning over even the most difficult of opponents. Okay, he's saying if you want to have the prince do what you want him to do, or have the king do what you want him to do, you're not going to be able to force him to do it. You're not going to be able to nag him into it. So how does he advise that a person proceeds if they're trying to win somebody over? Well, he gives some advice that's contrary to our flesh and our natural way of doing things. The first one is forbearance, okay? He says in verse 15, by long forbearing. So what does that mean, to forbear?
Giving advice and ask, or holding yourself off.
Okay, so forbearance is to be holding back a little bit, right? And so it's long forbearance. It's a matter of self-control, right? Because whenever you want something done or you want someone to do something for you, you want it to happen now. And what does that usually cause you to do?
Be impatient.
Be impatient. What does that cause you to do?
Be pushy.
Okay, so you're not careful with your words, you are maybe a little overzealous, pushy, right? And that's how people tend to do. They're pushing and they're irritating and they're aggravating and they're constantly reminding and over and nagging and whatnot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get them to do what you want them to do. But Solomon says that if we have patience, we don't want to be impatient and impassioned. We don't want to argue them into submission, but we don't want to be presenting reasons and pressing for a response. But in reality, we need patience. That's what is going to pay off. If you're dealing with a reasonable person, you give them time to think and time to weigh things out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it really makes sense to me. Because if you're pushing and pushing and pushing, but you're never actually giving them a chance to do their research and think about it, then they're not going to be as apt to go along with it.
Yeah.
Like, give me a chance to think about it, right? Don't pressure or be forceful, and keep the door open. So it's coming back and reminding, coming back and asking once in a while, but don't demand that it happens right now and don't be pushing them into it, because you're just going to get a closed door that way. A lot of times, whenever you push people, you're met with resistance, right? And so don't pressure, be forceful. To be forceful or annoying or rushed is going to make them more likely to resist or to reject whatever you're proposing. Yeah. And the second thing, we said forbearance, and the second thing is soft words. It says there in the second part of that, a soft tongue breaketh the bone. It's not actually talking about literally breaking bones with your tongue, right?
Right.
But the old saying is, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. And that's applied to harsh and critical words hurting someone's feelings. It's not going to hurt them physically, it will hurt their feelings. But this is talking about not harsh and critical words, it's talking about soft words. And it's going to end up winning over their heart. Okay? Anger and threats and manipulation aren't the way to go. Kindness, respect, and well-chosen words will get you much further than tantrums and outbursts. So treat others with respect, carry yourself with dignity, and you'll get a lot further than going through life as a selfish brute. Okay? So he says, if you got something you want accomplished, then be patient with it, give the other person some time, and treat them well, speak well to them. Okay, verses 16 and 17. And that's where we'll end. Hast thou found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for thee, lest thou be filled therewith and vomit it. Withdraw thy foot from thy neighbor's house, lest he be weary of thee and so hate thee. And so these verses are teaching us about knowing when to quit or when it's enough, right? Honey was seen as a good thing, but having too much of a good thing can cause problems. Says, eat as much as is sufficient for you. Know when to stop. Eat till you're satisfied. Don't make yourself sick. So that's good advice for eating. Not just honey, but anything. Know when to stop. But it's not just talking about eating. It's not just talking about honey. It's that way with many problems, or with many things, that even good things, if we have too much of it, can cause problems in our lives.
Yeah.
We overindulge and it creates problems. Work is a good thing, but if you do it to the point of neglecting your health or your family, that's a bad thing.
Right.
Rest is a good thing, but you don't want to be lazy.
Right.
Food is a good thing. Money is a good thing, but if you don't know how or when to stop, it's going to cause problems for you. And then verse number 17, we are warned not to overstay our welcome, not to become a burden. This was especially needful in Bible days because culture demanded hospitality.
Yes.
Could you imagine if it was still to this day that culture, or in this place was that culture, that if you had someone traveling through, you didn't go to a hotel, you didn't rent an Airbnb, you knocked on someone's door and said, hey, we're traveling through, you got an extra room for us. And then the expectation was that you would welcome them in.
Mm-hmm.
And for you to reject someone was a dishonor, was a shame, right? If we think about in Jesus' day, whenever they come to Samaria and the Samaritans will not welcome them in and will not give them hospitality, it makes the disciples so mad they want to call fire down from heaven and consume the whole city.
Yeah.
That lets us know a little bit about how ingrained this idea of hospitality was, okay? And so it's telling the person who's traveling through, the one who is receiving from someone else, don't be greedy with it.
Right.
Don't overstay. Don't take too much. Don't be a burden on other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can imagine people taking advantage of this and saying, hey, they can't tell me no, and it would be rude to kick me out. I'm your new tenant. I live here now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it says, withdraw your foot from the neighbor's house, lest he be weary of thee and so hate thee. So know when to stop, know when to leave. And that's an extremely practical thing. It's not just, you know, stay in the night, never stay in your welcome. It's like, hey, I want to go visit so-and-so and I'll be there for a month. They don't want you there for a month.
Right.
Or if you're going over to visit your neighbor and they've got so many things to do and they're trying to get things done and you won't shut up and leave.
Yeah.
I guess the modern saying would be read the room.
Yes.
Be in tune to other people's needs and other people's wishes rather than just being self-focused. And so don't take advantage of others' hospitality or their kindness. You're not the main character. You need to consider others. Mm-hmm. And another way to put it is, and this goes a little bit deeper, don't stay in a room you're not wanted in. And so this is more than just hospitality. But whenever you get the idea that people don't want you around, don't stick around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a good rule for life. And we don't take it personally. It's just like, this isn't my group. This isn't my people. They don't want me here, so I don't want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And you remove yourself. Don't try to make yourself fit where you don't belong.
All right.
I guess would be a good way to put that. So, any questions or comments on what we've looked at? Okay, then.